It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The killing of a top Iranian official by the U.S., followed by Iranian missile strikes in Iraq. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Over the last week, the United States and Iran has faced off in Iraq. It began with the killing of a top Iranian military leader, Qassem Soleimani, by the United States. And just this week, the Iranians struck back with missile attacks on two military bases with U.S. forces in Iraq. Now it appears both nations have set back from a major confrontation, but the future is still uncertain. With us in the studio this morning is Mukhtar Khan. He's an author as well as professor of political science, international relations at the University of Delaware. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Don.
So what is your overall sense, first of all, as to where we are in terms of this confrontation? It looks as if people are scaling back. Certainly the Iranians seem to be doing that. The president seems to also be doing the similar thing. Where are, do you think we are at this point?
Well, I think as far as the crisis is concerned, it has de-escalated in the sense that it is not going to have the same sense of urgency that we witnessed in the media the last two, 3 days. But I don't think that the issues are going away. So the probability, the fear that people were raising about, oh, this is going to lead to a military confrontation between Iran and the U.S., a war with Iran. Some people even went to the extent of saying this is the beginning of the Third World War. But I think all of those are exaggerated. Iran is a very ambitious power, but its capabilities do not match its power, its ambitions. So Iran is, I don't think, going to take on the U.S. In a military confrontation. A few years ago, there was one confrontation in which the United States practically devastated Iranian Navy. And Iran doesn't even have an air force. So for it to, with a very weak economy, I don't think there is a contest there. But Iran has lots of assets, such as proxies in various Middle Eastern countries, a network of intelligence, and asymmetrical warriors that it can summon. And so it is quite possible that while Iran may not confront the U.S. militarily, it may continue to hurt U.S. interests, U.S. assets, and U.S. allies in the region wherever and whenever it can. And now it has a greater incentive to do that because while in public, Trump actually allowed Iran to save face, but they would like to send the message to the U.S. that you can't keep doing this to us, and there is a cost to it. And I think we will eventually see some kind of retaliation from Iran. But the end game for President Trump essentially is a diplomatic solution. He wants a better deal than what President Obama was able to get. So whatever these skirmishes are all about, it's very clear that Trump wants to sit down with the Iranians and basically get a better deal.
The president responds in part to a justification for the actions he's taken by looking back at history. That is to say, talking about the Iranians seizing vessels, the Iranian attacks, sparring attacks on the Saudi oil fields, U.S. drone that was shot down. We're getting kind of this pushback, as it were, by Iran as it faces these increasing sanctions and the U.S. policy. How does one explain those particular events? Are they as collective as, for instance, the president would have us believe, that they are part of a larger strategy or a larger pushback, or are they just individual incidents?
Well, the U.S. and Iran have been doing this to each other for several years now. We have hacked into their nuclear facilities. We have released viruses into their systems. There are rumors that even the nuclear scientists have been assassinated either by the U.S. or by Israel. So both sides have been, you know, basically taking pot shots at each other. But Iran, I think, went too far when it hit the Saudi refineries. And then, of course, a contractor was killed. And then Iran unleashed its proxies on U.S. embassy. So those things, I think, went a bit too far. And it gave the Trump administration an opportunity to send the message to Iran that we are not the previous administrations, we are willing to escalate. And so killing of Soleimani was really kind of a game changer, a step up to basically saying, well, let's change the nature of the game. Can Iran play that game? I mean, is Iran now capable of assassinating America's chief of staff in Canada or somewhere else, right? Iran can't match that. So I think the message that the Trump administration probably has sent to Iran is that, look, not only are we willing to put new sanctions, put maximum pressure, but we are also willing to wield the stick in a way that hasn't been done in the past. So that message is very clear to the Iranians. And I think Iran's retaliation acknowledged that. I mean, their retaliation was designed to cause minimum damage. So basically, they fired missiles in the wrong direction. Either they have really bad targeting technology or they deliberately missed their targets because they did not want to give Trump another opportunity to hit some major targets in Iran itself. So far, the battle is happening outside Iran, and we haven't hit Iran directly, publicly, ever before, and I don't think the Iranians would like to open that door for the United States. Then everybody else in the future will be doing that. Having said all that, I think that the Trump administration have mishandled the diplomacy as well as the selling of the event at home. In fact, one of their biggest supporters, Tucker Carlson, Fox News, was their biggest critique, and Trump actually said that after listening to Carlson, he kind of reformulated his position. I think we should rename Fox News as a policy planning cell rather than the State Department. But I have a feeling that this is the beginning of a new direction in U.S.-Iranian relations. It remains to be seen, but it also has made it very clear that now we are not confronting Iran with, P5 plus one. We are alone internationally and domestically. Also, right now, there is not much support. The last survey that I saw suggested that only 25% of Americans were interested in a military confrontation with Iran. Over 75% are okay with sanctions.
How significant was Soleiman in terms of his record, in terms of what he did, and what kind of loss do you think that is for the regime?
Well, Soleimani, in terms of his status, was head of one of the divisions, the Quds division, part of the IRGC. He's a four-star general. He was not even the highest military ranking officer. However, over the last few years, he had kind of developed his own profile. He was taking selfies with his proxies. There was a lot of media attention being paid to him. And there were rumors that the Supreme Commander Khamenei saw him as his son. When he was leading his funeral prayers, he cried. And he cried so much that he was not able to recite the Quran properly. So there are these messages that he was a very important hero of the country. There were also rumors that after his military career, perhaps he would be running for president of Iran. So all of that hype was being built. But he is also quite a hated character. Sunnis, Syrians, etc., hate him. It is because of him and he built a lot of Iranian proxies in the Gulf, like Hezbollah and other Shia militias, and they were instrumental in preserving and saving Assad's regime in Syria, and they have committed a lot of atrocities against those who opposed Assad. So there's a lot of blood on his hands. He has killed a lot of Iraqis and Syrians, and even some of his creations have been creating a lot of havoc in places like Yemen and Lebanon, so on and so forth. So he has a lot of blood on his hands. By some estimates, he has killed anywhere between 1,100 to 1,700 Americans, so all those IEDs, etc., technology which were being used by terrorists in Iraq are rumored to have come from IRGC and him. He has also helped the Taliban in some ways. So there is this perception that he was like the mastermind of geopolitics in the region. But you must understand that he's not like Baghdadi or bin Laden. Killing him is not going to dent the institution. He could have retired next year and run for president. so someone else is going to take his position. And so in that sense, neither he didn't make Iranian foreign policy. He only executed it in a particular region. So I don't think the regime's policies are going to change because Soleimani is dead. I mean, I don't think killing him has eliminated the institutional capacity of IRGC, the Republican Guards. So in that sense, from a tactical and strategic perspective, I don't think we have gained significantly. The assassination has symbolic value, no doubt, and some of them is positive and some of it is negative.
Someone suggested, I heard the other day, that one of the reasons why Soleimani and people like him developed various proxies around the region was in the aftermath of the Iran-Iraq War, the original one, the 1980s, that the Iranian leadership said, we can't allow this to happen again, that we need other forces outside in order to create pressure. Do you think that's true in terms of projecting Iranian influence and staving off, perhaps?
I think that the sanctions on Iran, the economic sanctions, and its inability to raise more and more money. Like right now, 90% of Iran's oil has been withdrawn from the market. So Iran is not able to get revenues for it. Iran, I think, is a net importer of petroleum right now because it's not able to sell, and so it's buying refined oil from elsewhere. But Iran also is not able to develop its military technology or buy military technology like, say, Saudi Arabia does. So Iran has to either develop indigenous capability. So it has invested in ballistic technology and has some missile capability, but it does not have a massive air force or a massive navy, which it could have had if all these sanctions were not in place. So it would have had a powerful military. It probably would have won the Iran-Iraq war if that had happened. So they realize that they need to develop a punitive capacity to hurt those powerful countries like Israel and the United States, which may attack it. So I think that the success of Hezbollah, especially in the war with Israel in 2007, where this militia of 5,000 people really stood up to the most powerful nation in the region, and fought it toe-to-toe for about a month like a military, I think that probably triggered and said, oh, wow, this is tremendous. With very little financial investment, we can develop proxies which give us two things. One, they give us reach way beyond our borders. So we can operate this. We can create proxies in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon. But not only that, it also gives Iran a bit of a deniability. You know, they can always say, we never ordered this, Hezbollah did it on its own, or this particular militia or did it on it. So it becomes a very useful tool. It is not very different from the terrorist groups that Pakistan has used, both towards Kashmir or Afghanistan. You have assets which can be deployed to do things beyond your borders, while also giving you some deniability.
So what does this all mean in terms of the Iranian presence in Iraq, as well as the U.S. presence? We had, obviously, the parliament passing a non-binding resolution calling for foreign forces to withdraw, particularly the United States, I guess, in this particular case. What does this do in terms, particularly, of the Iranian influence and presence in Iraq, as well as the official U.S. presence?
Well, I don't have any evidence, but I suspect that one of the reasons why Trump has de-escalated is because of the step that the Iraqi parliament took. If they had passed a binding resolution, then United States military presence, at least according to international law, would have been illegal in Iraq. And that would have been a big blow to the U.S., not only in its war against ISIS, but also a U.S. military presence in Iraq is a deterrence to Iran, and it is also some comforting to allies like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. So the United States wishes to continue to have some military presence in Iraq. We have invested nearly $2 trillion in the Iraq project, but the fact is, if in the last few days we see that Iraq seems to be at least politically more aligned with Iran than with the United States, and that raises the question as to what is the political and strategic value of the kind of wars we have fought in the Middle East lately. and raises the issue that maybe we need to rethink our presence in the Middle East more fundamentally.
Do you think that this allows the Iranians to perhaps have a greater amount of influence in Iraq? When I think about, for instance, the U.S. has only a very small portion of troops there, and it seems as if the Iranians' influence has certainly grown over the years. On the other hand, we certainly have had some pushback. We saw some protests against Iranian presence. So the Iraqis themselves are not necessarily crazy about the Iranians being there, even though they're both, for all intents and purposes, are Shiite.
Well, it is a bit premature, but I think in the long run, Iraq will be to Iran what Europe has been to the U.S.
And so?
That we have tremendous influence in Europe, while there is anti-Americanism in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The public may protest, but the governments will be in line. So we will see the same thing. There will be protests in the public against Iran, but the governments of Iraq will potentially, on most important issues in the long run, align with Iran. Iran's influence on Iraq is more through its soft power. Iraq is a Shia majority state. Iran is a Shia majority, a Shia state, nearly 95% plus. Some of the most important religious sites are in Iraq. So there is going to be a lot of tourism, religious tourism between Iran and Iraq. People going to Qom in Iran, going to Najaf in Iraq. So in that sense, those ties, which were kind of blocked by Sunni authoritarianism, has disappeared. You know, in 2003, a lot of historians were saying that for centuries, Sunnis have held on to Baghdad and Shias have tried to get it, and we helped reverse this balance of power in that part of the Arab world. So the United States will have to acknowledge that in the long run, Iran will have tremendous cultural and political influence in most of the countries in the region which have significant Shia populations. That is something that we have never... Our foreign policy does not acknowledge the capacities which are potentialities which are natural to the region for countries like Iran and sometimes even China and Russia, and we go against it, and that is where we fail. And I think that the United States' image in the Middle East is nothing to crow about, really. Yes, there are people who hate Iran, but they also hate the United States. So,
what does this mean all in terms of for ISIS, in terms of their survival, what's in the region?
Well, you must see, one of the things that I don't think Americans have realized is that one of Soleimani's shall we say, achievements was his defeating ISIS on the ground. It was the Shia militias. The Iraqi army that we trained and built just ran away from Mosul, right, without a fight. The people
right.
who really fought on the ground were the Shia militias who were, and the Kurdish militias. Turkey didn't fight ISIS directly. Neither did the Iraqi military play a better role, but the Iranian militias. It's like, you know, the Russians say that we always forget the role that Russia played in defeating Germany in World War II. And similarly, we don't acknowledge the role that Iran has played in defeating ISIS, both in Iraq and Syria. Yes, they also, in the process, ended up preserving and saving the Assad regime, which will continue to raise tensions in the region. But I don't think this means that Iran is going to be exercising lesser influence in Iraq. So I think that all the operations that Soleimani was running will be run. Now it just depends on how competent the next guy really is. But I think the infrastructure, the architecture of proxy security that Soleimani had built remains in place. We have not destroyed that, nor have we reduced its legitimacy. In fact, right now, because of the way we dealt with Soleimani, we have united the Iranian population behind the regime, made the regime more secure. There was a chance that this regime could have been toppled by its own people, given the nature of the economy and the sufferings as a result of the additional sanctions that we had posed. But there is also now anger among the Iraqi ruling elite against the United States, and more countries are going to question U.S. military presence there.
Do you think that this means an end to ISIS, that once the U.S. pulls out, and obviously the Iranians are not crazy about them, and they've, as you said, been fighting them both in Iraq and Syria?
Syria, the ISIS exploded for two or three reasons. One, because there was a power vacuum in that region. And so they were able to quickly grab a lot of land. And then the fact that they were able to have these military victories was the source of attraction and appeal, and so they were able to recruit. But now they don't look like a winning organization. they're on the defense, they're on the run, they are defeated, their leaders have been killed. So I don't think they have any attraction and recruitment appeal. So the recruitment is down, their capacity to continue to remain in the news is down. If you read the 2017 national security document produced by the White House, I wonder whether the White House itself has read it, but Mattis and the previous national security advisor may have put it together. We have clear acknowledgement that we are back to geopolitics. We have moved away from the global war on terror and gone to old-fashioned geopolitics. We are now looking not at non-state actors as a major threat, but we are looking at regional powers and global powers as threats. So it's Russia and China on the global sphere, China as an economic challenge, Russia as a security threat on the global level, and potential nuclear powers like North Korea and Iran as regional threats. So we are back to old-fashioned geopolitics, which is itself an acknowledgement that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have lost their ability to threaten the United States, at least.
Where does it, for instance, leave the Sunnis, say, for instance, in Iraq?
Well, the Sunnis are going to be like the Kurds in Syria and Iraq. They are going to be discriminated against. They are getting a taste of their own medicine, so to speak, in Iraq. They had an opportunity to become part of the democratic process. They themselves boycotted the constitutional process of Iraq very early on. But the job in terms of what the United States did was still incomplete, in the sense that I think that if Iraq ultimately wants to become a more stable democracy, then it'll have to rejig its constitution and give more room and more opportunities, both economic and political, to its Sunni minority. Otherwise, it will continue to radicalize its own population, or at least make them feel disenchanted.
Where does this lead Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia must, I think the leadership of Saudi Arabia must have spent sleepless nights, because if Iranian missiles can't hit Los Angeles and New York, but they certainly can hit Riyadh and Jeddah. So if there was a military confrontation, I can tell you that Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and Saudi targets, oil refineries, would have been one of the earliest targets that Iran would hit. Because with each passing moment, we would be degrading their assets, right? We would destroy their ability to shoot missiles, maybe their radar systems, etc. So if I was an Iranian general, the first thing I would do is hit as many things as I can before the U.S. destroys my capacity to hit. And so, yes, it makes the Saudi position very precarious. But something interesting has happened. Just as in the second term of Obama, the Saudis lost confidence in the U.S., they're already losing confidence in the United States right now. They are not sure of the U.S. After the Khashoggi affair. So the first 2 years of the Trump administration was like a honeymoon. Now they are both looking for divorce lawyers, I think. So Saudi Arabia should be feeling very insecure. In fact, there are rumors that at the behest of the United States, General Soleimani was brought to Iraq in order to initiate some kind of a de-escalation dialogue with the Saudis. And the Iraqis didn't know that the U.S. was going to assassinate him. Otherwise, they would not have shared that intelligence. But I also think that even the U.S. didn't know. I think this is a spur-of-the-moment decision made by the president for, to a great extent, domestic politics. So he's going to run for office now saying, Obama killed bin Laden, but I got Baghdadi and Soleimani. Yes, two for one.
So where does this leave the region in terms of stability?
Well, the region is, I don't think this makes the region more stable at all. In fact, you know, a few years ago, a new literature started appearing on failed states. I think we need to start looking at failed regions. And I think the Middle East has become, especially the Arab Middle East, not so much of North Africa, but the proper Middle East has become a failed region, badly governed, insecure, at war with each other. It's sometimes very difficult to see who's not fighting whom. Now with the further aggressive entry of Turkey, not just in Syria, but also in Libya, and the inability, you know, there was lots of attempts by Saudi Arabia to establish the Sunni army and stuff, and that failed. And then now Erdogan and Mahathir tried to establish an alternative collective security group that met in late December in Malaysia. And then Imran Khan, who was supposed to be part of it, bailed out because the Saudis threatened to, I guess, cut economic aid to Pakistan. So there are lots of divisions in the region, and they are not able to act collectively, nor are they able to act coherently. So yes, we will see more instability. And the U.S., unfortunately, in the past acted as a stabilizing force, but nowadays the U.S. is also a destabilizing force in the region. There is nobody who's stabilizing the region. Everybody is adding to the mess.
We've been speaking with Mukhtar Khan. He is an author and also a professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The nation has been riveted by the standoff between the U.S. and Iran. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The latest events saw the killing of Qassem Soleimani and the missile counterstrike against the military bases in Iraq. But this conflict may not simply be political or military, but also cultural. We have in our studio this morning Dr. Jacques Coco. He's associate professor in the Conflict Analysis and Dispute Resolution Department at Salisbury University, also author of a new book entitled Mindful of Cultures and Conflicts. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don, for having me.
So how do you read this this conflict that we're now seeing being played out in terms of Iran and the United States, particularly from a cultural point of view? We've been stressing the politics of it, what the Iranians may want and not want in terms of material influence abroad and, I suppose, the United States interests. How do you see this conflict?
I think you're right. You know, what's happening is not only political, but also cultural. And we can look at all that from a very cultural perspective. See, Iran is a theocratic, you know, regime. You know, I mean, we are an Islamic country, Islamic Republic. So whatever is happening there is like, you know, it's dictated by God, you know, from their perspective. And when you go ahead and you kill a general, it's a major crime. I mean, they can't accept that, you know. Imagine, you know, us killing Moses, you know, or Joshua. Moses and Joshua, the kind of figures they represent in Judaism, it's a powerful figure, right? It's pretty much the same thing, you know, with Iran. You know, when we go and we kill Soleimani, he's like, you know, a hero. He's like God chosen, which is why we saw all the Iranian gather to support, you know, whatever their regime was to decide against that killing. So that's pretty much cultural. Regardless of their differences, when it comes to killing one of their general, they feel like their culture, you know, is under attack. And we saw that on the streets, all the demonstrations and so on.
I mean, we look at this as the gathering of support for him in a nationalist point of view, that is, looking at Iran as a national figure, and therefore that we might look at, for instance, if there was a killing, for instance, of a U.S. official. But you seem to indicate that this goes beyond simply a nationalist sentiment.
Very well. That's right. I mean, Soleimani was like a symbolic figure. He reflected a culture. And we are in a culture where pride matters, you know. They like to take pride. So the symbol he represented was a very important symbol for the culture of Iran. And they could not accept us killing him without reacting. And Iran's reaction was pretty much to save face. Face saving is another aspect of their culture. The leaders, they wanted to do something to show their people that, okay, they responded regardless of what they did. They needed to respond.
It does seem, though, that the response was hardly as dramatic as the act that precipitated it.
Again, you know, like I said, you know, it's because of the notion of face saving. Think of it. I mean, Iran and the U.S., we have the most powerful military on Earth. So Iran knows that they cannot engage in a conflict with us and win. But they needed to do something to satisfy the needs of their people. All the people that went on the streets to demonstrate in support for Soleimani, they were like, you know what? We need revenge. The regime in Iran is aware that they cannot engage in a war with the U.S. and win. So what they did is to just like console their people with strike without doing any damage. But at the same time, this also reflects the goodwill of the Iranian people. You know, if Iran wanted to kill our soldiers, they have done it. I mean, the missile they launched were like sophisticated precision missiles. And they selected not to kill us, pretty much. And that will happen.
So how do you see this in terms of how the United States looks at this killing, the decision to go ahead and kill him, and this reference back to certainly to the Iraq conflict, the insurgency that that took place in the first decade of the thousands? How do you see this being seen from Washington?
Pretty much, you know, our leaders in Washington, you know, they're all product of their culture. We are all product of our culture. Every human being is a product of their culture. So looking at history, they're trying to like justify, you know, their actions, what they're doing, and so on. And when you read, you know, what they're doing, they try to fit in a pattern, you know, the Western pattern. We want to win. We want to win. And we need to do everything we can do to win. We can't blame them. Like I said, they are product of their culture.
I mean, is there an underlying sense about how we view the world that pushes us in a particular direction? I mean, I can imagine, for instance, that there might be down the road, folks will be talking about if the U.S. is, say, withdraws from Iraq, that then the question will be who lost Iraq?
Well, indeed, you know, we see the world from our worldview. The U.S. believe that, you know, we are a superpower. We are above everybody. We dictate our laws and rules to everybody, and they will accept. But we need to be very careful in how we do it, because the people we are dictating our rules, our laws to, they also have their cultures. Name them Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, and so on. And the kind of democracy, for instance, that we want to spread around, how to make sure that it fits in their culture. Think of it. Democracy is different depending on the country that you are in, you know, including in the Western countries. Democracy in France is different from what it is in the U.S. And democracy in the U.S. is different from what it is in India. Democracy in India is different from what it is in Senegal. And they're all democracies. So cultural dynamics affect, you know, political regime. Which is why when we want to dictate democracy or spread democracy to Iraq, we don't understand why Iraqis resist our democracy. Simply because of their culture. Their culture tolerates certain patterns of democracy and rejects others. And we want to be very careful, you know, when we are involved in policy making, in analyzing all those cultural dynamics to know how to fit in without imposing our ways of life to others.
So, by fact, turning to Iraq, which was really an instance of nation building, even though that's not what they had planned and when they invaded, how do you assess what went wrong in terms of how the Bush folks saw Iraq? I mean, I remember, for instance, Bush's, I think it was his second inaugural address, talking about spreading democracy across the Middle East, that if you got democracy here, then you get democracy in other places. Where do you think they went wrong here?
pretty much what happened in Iraq was the fact that we were looking at them as evil and we are good. You know, the dynamic of us versus them, which depict us as good and them as evil. No, they're not evil. And we're not only good. Every human being possesses within it, him or her, goods and bad. We all have our strengths, but also our limitations, regardless of who we are. They are Iraqi people that are wonderful people. And they are US people that are wonderful people. There are some Iraqi leaders that are great people. And some of our leaders are on the are great people as well. But each of us, whether we are in a position of leadership or not, in addition to our qualities, we have our weaknesses. Now, the Bush administration, you know, did amazing thing. But one, in my opinion, of the problem they had was that dichotomy of depicting Iraqis or the Iraq regime as evil and us as, you know, good people. And that's, I know it's from Samuel Huntington, Clashes of Civilization, where he tried to, like, you know, divide the world civilization into 9 civilizations, and, you know, including, you know, the Islamic civilization, you know, the Western civilization. They really used Samuel Huntington to feed that war in Iraq. And that was, in my opinion, not the best approach.
So in terms of U.S. and how it views the world, one of the things that seems to be the basis for U.S. foreign policy in general, and also how we see ourselves, is what I guess what we call American exceptionalism. We see ourselves certainly breaking away from the old world, which was Europe, and creating something new, so that when we rolled in, for instance, at the end of, for instance, the Second World War, we were the good guys. We were spreading democracy. We were trying to create the societies, both in Japan and Germany in particular, that looked far more like us. Does that then have a problem once you begin to move outside of that Western sphere?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the culture we are in the West is not the same culture people are in Iran, in Iraq, you know, in Africa, in Asia, in Afghanistan, Latin America. Once we leave the Western, you know, barriers, we are in completely different cultures. I mean, which is also called the dynamic of high context cultures versus low context cultures. In some cultures, people that speak between the line, you have to read between the line. They're not like direct. They're not overt as we are here. So we need to like interpret their manners. When I hear, when I tell you, this is good, I mean it, it's good. And we can agree on that. But then, they only need to, like, you know, roll their eye for you to understand that it's not good. Think of it. When you are involved in negotiation with Iraqi officials, done. You're sitting down comfortably as a diplomat, and the sole of your shoes is, like, facing, you know, the other party. You know, I mean, the counterpart, mm-hmm. the people you're negotiating with. In our culture, that's accepted. I'm sitting, crossing my legs, and the sole of my shoes is like facing, you know, my counterpart. That's accepted. We do that all the time. But in a culture like Iraq, when you do such a thing, it's like an insult to the other party. They will not accept it. And that alone can disrupt the negotiation process. And when in the Bush administration, when, you know, they happened, you know, he traveled, he went to Iraq, and one of the journalists threw, you know, his shoes at him. I mean, in the news here, we did not understand the meaning of it. But in their culture, when somebody grabbed their shoes and threw their shoes at you, it's like the greatest humiliation they could inflict upon you, which is what that journalist did. I mean, he really, really insulted our president. Peak in their culture. We did not understand that fully in our culture, in the news here. You know, our interpretations were like all over the place, except, you know, the true meaning of it. You know, so to kind of, you know, recap, whatever we do fits within the parameters of our cultures, the Western cultures. But when we go beyond the barriers of our culture, then, you know, the meaning changes completely.
Let me ask you this on the other side of this thing, which is Iran. Given their own particular culture, do you think that they understand where the Americans are coming from and their cultural biases and prejudices. And for that matter, you know, the Iranians have influence throughout the region, mm-hmm. to say the least. Do they understand even the countries that they are involved with, particularly since you've got, for instance, obviously the conflicts between Shia and Sunni and so on and so forth? I mean, what is their shortcoming, as it were?
I think, you know, it's a very interesting question, and it will be difficult for me to speak on behalf of the Iranian that they understand or they do not, you know. It all depends, you know. Some people might understand if they really engage with our cultures. I mean, working with our people from our cultures, diplomats, and so on, and vice versa. But others will not understand. We can only understand other people's culture if we engage with them in a dialogue. Which is why in my book, I talk about, you know, intercultural dialogue. We learn to understand one another when we engage, you know, with one another in dialogues, you know, bridging the, you know, the cultures through dialogue. That's critical. So Iranian will understand where we're coming from only when they engage with us and when we engage with them, which is why I believe it's a very sad, you know, in my opinion, position to, like, you know, not allowing the Iranian foreign minister to get a visa to come express himself before the UN. We have to make sure that we promote dialogue regardless of our differences. We disagree. We are different. That's, you know, cultural. And we cannot eliminate that. We cannot eliminate our differences. We cannot destroy them. We have to find a way to engage with one another, though. That's critical for us to be safe. I would like explain it. We need a family, you know. We are, like, you know, family members and so on. But we're still different. Dad is different from mom. Mom is different from dad. The kids are different in terms of culture. Maybe I'm shocking you, but it's a factor. It's a fact. I mean, don't think of it. The kind of culture your kids, they navigate in daily, you know, at school, the movie they watch, the book they read, and so on. It's not exactly the same culture that you are in daily. Even though your kids, they have the same ancestry that you do, and so on. Their culture will be different from your culture. The core, of course, will remain the same. The core cultural will remain the same. But the cultural connotations, the colors, the decorations that add to their culture affect their culture and the way they be. And when you see labor, to get along, to engage with one another, to talk to them, and they talk to you, they call you father, and so on. We need to find a way to bring that up on the international level. Our differences should not divide us to the point that we're not able to engage with one another. And I think it would be great that we can engage with Iran.
Let me ask you this, because there seems to be some disconnect between, on the one hand, the Iranian people who have gone, they've demonstrated, and as a matter of fact, I remember hearing a report where they would decry the United States. And then when somebody found out that someone was an American, they had plenty of questions, they liked them, and so on. There seems to be a disconnect between governmental policy, foreign policy, the theocracy, as it were, as opposed to the people below who may not like what the U.S. government is doing, but nonetheless like Americans. I mean, there seems to be a dichotomy here.
That's a great point. Indeed, you know, the people, what their leaders are doing does not always reflect their values, their feeling, their positions. And I've been, you know, around the globe, and it's amazing to see how people react, you know, when they see you coming from the U.S. They're really welcoming, including on the streets of Tehran, in Baghdad. The same people who are heavily criticizing the policy of your government, who are against, you know, whatever your government is doing, they welcome you. I was listening to NPR yesterday, and I was amazed, you know, to hear that, you know, one of the journalists of NPR was, you know, in Tehran having a coffee with, you know, an Iranian professor, and, you know, everybody around her was, like, excited, welcoming, warm, and so on. And the Iranian professor was telling her, if you live here and you tell everybody that you're from America, then they might try to see you from a different angle because they will remember all the policies of your government. But if, I mean, you stay beyond the arena of politics, they will really welcome you and so on. What does that mean? It means that whatever rhetoric you know, we're hearing in the news from our leaders does not always reflect the cultural realities of the countries that we think we are in war with. And that's where what I call multi-track diplomacy plays in. We have to find a way to engage the people in those countries at the grassroots level. For instance, reaching out to the students' population at the University of Tehran, for instance, and finding a way to exchange students, you know, between our country and their country, it will be a powerful way to start building peace from the bottom up, like we say in the language of conflict resolution and peace building.
In terms of Iran, do you think that the government and the way it controls the country, obviously there's been dissent. We've seen that just recently against the government in terms of policies and how the Iranians are living. But do you think that kind of popular sentiment can change a government like, say, Iran?
Well, pretty much, you know, I mean, every government has their limitation. I mean, there's nothing like perfect regime, you know, and so on. In my book, I praised democracy. You know, democracy is a very good political system, but democracy has its shortcoming, you know, and we all are aware of it. And, you know, I mean, we don't need to say much about it before we understand what we mean, you know. And then autocratic regime also, you know, they have their shortcoming and so on. I mean, in a country like Iran, we see a regime that is very autocratic and oppressing people, repressing their own people, in some cases, killing their own people and so on. But I think, you know, advocating for a regime change, you know, by force is not, in my opinion, the best approach. We have to find a way to do things diplomatically, you know. And like I said, multi-track diplomacy is a very good approach. Having the people, mobilizing the people to express their will, to do, you know, what they want to do, will end up bringing a change that comes from the bottom up.
One final question before I go to your book here, and that is that it seems to me that when people advocate for democracy, what really one should be advocating for is liberal democracy. I.e., that is to say, not only obviously people go and they vote, but you also have to have checks, for instance, on the tyranny of the majority, which is obviously something that Madison talked about. And there was some great concern, as a matter of fact, by the founders in this country. Is the concept of liberal democracy something that you think it will spread? You think that's a good idea? How do you promote that ideal, if indeed you agree with it?
Well, when you go to, you know, the root of democracy in Greece, you see that to some extent, every type of democracy is liberal. You know, it's liberal. I mean, they really want to make sure that the people participate in the government, they have their say and so on. But regardless of the type of democracy you're dealing with here, there will always be people who will be dissatisfied, which is where the checks and balance come in to help. And it's, in my opinion, you know, a disaster when in a democracy system there is no checks and balance, or there is a tendency to suppress or negate the checks and balance system, which unfortunately is what, you know, is happening in many countries now around the world, which pretend to be democratic country, but they are willing to suppress the checks and balance. The checks and balance are pretty much what makes democracy democratic.
Let me turn to your book, Mindful of Cultural Conflicts. And the first question was for me was, why did you decide to use fiction and these various characters to illustrate all the kinds of ideas we've just been talking about?
Thank you. Fiction reflects the world. Fiction reflects people's stories. And storytelling is a powerful way to spread or reflect reality, the daily life. So that's the only reason why I resorted to fiction. Yeah.
So tell me then a little bit about the character, the first characters with the young woman and her family, which I guess is of Hispanic origin.
Well, pretty much, culture is not Hispanic per se, but it's Latin, the Latin culture.
Anyway, yeah.
The Latin, of course, Latin, you know, gave birth to French, Spanish, Portuguese, and all the Romanic languages that we are aware of. So to some extent, you know, I can give you the benefit of the doubt, you know, that it reflects some Spanish. But in culture, you know, I want to reflect many different cultures, you know, from the Western world and beyond. And she is a character that, you know, shows how culture can be tricky, challenging.
Describe her culture for us.
So culture pretty much, you know, reflects a culture which is very, you know, exclusive. You know, they want to make sure that they open up only to their people, the people who are like them. You know, anybody who is not like them, you know, they don't want to do anything with it. You know, they will exclude you if you're not part of their circle and so on.
It seems very, I guess, conservative in the traditional, I guess, American sense anyway.
Well, I won't say American, you know, but conservative to some extent, because not all Americans are conservative. You know, there are many Americans who are, right, you know, who will not depict themselves as conservative. But you're right, it's conservative.
Right. I mean, in terms of like the death penalty and abortion and those, I mean, the various, particularly the various social issues.
Right, right. You know, they're very, you know, conservative on the social issue. Abortion, no. Death penalty, yes. And some other issue like gun and so on. Yeah.
So, and when she goes out and meets people or talks to people who she doesn't know, her mother gets upset.
That's right. You know, her mom doesn't want her to meet anybody who is not part of their circle and so on. So we see that, you know, in many, you know, instances, you know, in our lives and so on.
Mm-hmm. And then you obviously have then her, I guess, her what becomes her boyfriend. Tell me about him and his family.
Ibu.
Which is much more different. Yeah, much more different in terms of where they come from.
Right. Ibu reflects a different culture, open-minded. You know, they will welcome you even if you're not part of their circle. And they will integrate you and so on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what inspired you? Are these particular characters come from people you know, or just they? What? How did you create them?
Well, they do not come from, you know, specific people I know, but you know they come from daily life. You know, things that I observe around my environment. I was privileged to travel around the globe. You know, I've observed, you know, dynamic of cultural conflicts in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America, you know, Canada and here. And I kind of, you know, capitalize on all those observations to put this book together.
At one point, she has a roommate, and they obviously have this dispute over keeping the apartment clean, right?
Right.
Her roommate likes to keep it clean. She's, on the other hand, has not done this because her mother took care of all this. But then Ibu comes along and instead of telling her to do something, he does something else. Tell me a little bit about that incident.
So pretty much, you know, roommate conflicts are conflict that we encounter, you know, a lot. So myself, I've been like a roommate with so many people when I was a student, and we've been caught into those type of conflict all the time. Yeah, that's right. You know, so pretty much, you know, you'll have like instances, myself included, where I come home and the sink is like, you know, full of dishes and stinking. And I will like call upon my roommate, hey, come on, let's, you know, clean this. And the answer in some cases will be no. I said, no, that's not fair. And then I would like, you know, demonize my roommate, you know, judge him and say all the nasty thing about him. Later on, I will find out that, no, it's not his fault. It's because of the culture he's coming from. That's a guy, a wonderful guy who grew up, you know, in a household where mom was the one doing everything. Mom will like wash the dishes. Mom will make his bed for him. Mom will sweep his room, the floor, do everything. And he spent like his entire, you know, youth without doing anything, without learning anything. And then, you know, he in college, 17, 18, how do you expect him to be able to wash the dishes if he has not learned that at home? How do you expect him to clean the apartment if he has not learned that at home? Now, me coming from a culture where mom was like pushing me to do everything in the morning. You have to wash the dishes on your own. You have to like make sure that, you know, you clean the bathroom. You have to make sure that you sweep the floor. You make your own bed. I mean, I grew up in that type of culture where I've learned, you know, to do all those things. So I come to college, I'm able to do them because I've learned them. I mean, should I blame my roommate who did not get the chance to grow up in a culture like my culture? I can't blame them. How do I know? By engaging with him. By like calming down when I see the sink dirty. You know, why are you not washing the dishes? Let's, you know, talk about it. And then we have a dialogue around it. And in that process, I discover who he is, where he's coming from. And then we tolerate one another. We move on to helping one another. and you know, it will be like a completely different situation than me judging him. You know, in a book somewhere I said that, you know, actually, you know, but being able to engage in a dialogue with your roommates, with your friend, heals them more than you condemning them. Like somebody said, you know, compassion cures more than condemnation.
What do you think that means, this story means, for the people who are trying to negotiate these grand agreements and trying to get nations together?
We pretty much, it's an invitation for us to pay attention to people's culture. You know, every human being is a product of their culture, like I said. And every country reflects a series of cultures. And those cultures are different from the cultures that we are in our country. We want to make sure that we pay attention to their culture and they pay attention to our culture. So when we are involved in international negotiation, let's be mindful to observe cultural dynamics and to pay attention to cultural dynamics.
Do you think the previous administration did that better than the current one?
Well, I don't want to, like, you know, get caught
too
into
political,
a game that, you know,
previous administrations in general.
I think, you know, every administration, you know, has its strengths and its challenges, and the times are not the same, you know. But it's a fact that, you know, being in a position of leadership is a very challenging thing, and we have to be mindful of everything we're doing. So my call here will be, like, you know, being mindful.
So if you were to be in the seconds that we have left, if you were to give some advice to the Secretary of State or the President, what would you be telling them about how to approach these countries?
Being mindful of the culture that we are dealing with.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jacques Coco. He's associate professor in the Conflict Analysis and Dispute Resolution Department at Salisbury University. Also has a new book called A Mindful of Cultures and Conflicts. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.